Okay. Welcome back. We're going to continue our analysis of common practice, and I'm going to hand over to Aisha, who's going to talk to us about pension-related disclosures and the work on IAS 19.
Exactly. Thanks, Anne, and good afternoon, everyone. I hope we're all energized by lunch and ready to have some exciting discussions about employee benefits. So as Anne mentioned, the focus of the next 90 minutes would be on our common reporting practice project on IAS 19 employee benefits. So why are we doing a common practice project on IAS 19? So as part of the board's disclosure initiative project, the board is actually reviewing the usefulness of the existing disclosure requirements in IAS 19. And this is part of the board's larger initiative to improve the effectiveness of disclosures and the financial statements for users by essentially embarking on developing guidance for how the board can better develop and draft disclosure objectives and requirements in the future. So IAS 19 was one of the two standards that the board selected as a good standard to essentially test the draft guidance, and this was on the basis of feedback from stakeholders, in particular also users, that some of the information they get about employee benefits could be improved. So the evidence that the board gathered as part of that disclosure initiative project essentially kind of signaled to us from a taxonomy perspective that it might be useful for us to look at whether the taxonomy currently, you know, supports the way companies are tagging disclosures about employee benefits in the appropriate manner. And an equally important objective of this research project is also to inform the board's disclosure initiative project. So some of you might recall at the last ITCG meeting when we discussed the details of that draft guidance for the board, some of the key considerations in that draft guidance is essentially the board thinking about the consequences and the effects of disclosure proposals on electronic reporting and IFRS taxonomy earlier on in the standard setting process. So one of the benefits of initiating this common practice research at this time, it allows us to essentially feed feedback into that board's project early on in the process, so we get taxonomy considerations much, much earlier on than the current status quo. So the scope of our research essentially covers all the different types of employee benefits that IAS 19 touches on. At this meeting, we're going to dive into the proposed improvements that we are suggesting as it relates to defined benefit plans. At a future ITCG meeting, we're looking to discuss with you those changes that we're proposing for the remaining types of employee benefits that IAS 19 covers. And then at that meeting as well, we'd be looking to consolidate and discuss with you the set of feedback on the remaining common practices that we don't want to make improvements, or we're not suggesting to make improvements with at this time, but we want the board to factor into its consideration of amendments to the disclosures in IAS 19. And the reason we've prioritized defined benefit plans for this meeting is because the feedback from the board's project indicates that this is a primary area of focus for users about employee benefits. So what timelines are we working with? So as it relates to the board's disclosure project, the board is currently in the process of developing tentative proposals about amendments to IAS 19. The current expectation is to publish an exposure draft, which would include amendments to the disclosures in IAS 19 sometime in Q3 of 2020. And that would be to, with a view to, for the comment letter period to end sometime in 2021. And then the board would continue on with its redeliberations based on the feedback it gets before issuing a final standard. For our common practice project, what this means, as I've mentioned earlier, is we're planning to have two meetings to discuss our findings with you, so starting with the discussions today and continuing on with a later meeting we're planning for in Q2 2020 of this this year. And that is towards our publishing a proposed taxonomy update on those improvements that you agree with sometime in Q4 of this year. So that gives us some time to incorporate any final changes towards the 2021 annual taxonomy. And then at that same time, we'll be looking to essentially share the feedback on the remaining common practice common practices we identified to the board's project. And as you can see, that fits into the time that the board would be considering the feedback it gets from the exposure draft itself before it looks at the final standard. And as with our normal due process, at the point the board issues a final standard on the amendments to IS 19, whenever that is, then we would also do our typical process of considering whether we need to update the taxonomy at that point. And I'll talk into a little bit more detail why it's the case that we're essentially having two phases of amendments to the taxonomy for employee benefits and why that we see that as something to do. So in terms of what we're aiming for in this session today, so we'll spend some time explaining the approach we've taken to analyzing the common practice findings on employee benefits. And then we're going to spend the most time that we have talking through three areas that we're proposing changes to the IFRS taxonomy at this time. So starting first with our approach. So the approach we've taken is pretty much similar to this approach taken in the common practice of the primary financial statements, which we've discussed just before lunch. So what we've done is to review the disclosures in the financial statements of SEC foreign private issuers as it relates to employee benefits. And that effort has essentially identified a number of common reporting practices that are not captured by the taxonomy specifically today. And some of that includes some diverse tagging approaches and sign errors. In terms of how it relates to the timing that the Disclosures Project is working on, so I mentioned earlier that the expectation is to publish an exposure draft in Q3 of 2020. And considering the comment period, the period of time the board is going to need to re-deliberate proposals after the comment period, and then the subsequent due process that the board has to go through towards making a final standard, the earliest date that the technical staff is expecting that a final standard could be issued on amendments to IS 19 is sometime in 2022. And that doesn't take into consideration the period of time we typically give for an amendment to become effective and then for common practice to subsequently emerge. So that's just essentially a long-winded way of saying it might take some time before any changes that the board is currently considering to IS 19 to take effect. So we asked ourselves whether it made sense to see whether, you know, improvements can be made at this time to improve the status quo as it relates to the effectiveness of disclosures that electronic users are getting about employee benefit disclosures. So this slide presents some arguments for and against making those changes at this time. The main concern is that, you know, the fact that the board is looking at making changes to the disclosures in IS 19 could mean that some of the common practices would be affected as a result. So any changes we might make to the taxonomy at this time could be redundant. However, the board is at an advanced stage in its pre-exposure draft discussions. And the board has developed, you know, tentative proposals which are based on detailed outreach that the board has taken with users. And from our analysis of those tentative proposals, some of the reporting practices that we've observed today, the disclosures they're based on, we're not expecting that they would be changed by the board's on thinking on that project. So the consequence of what the board is essentially doing on that project is that it could either remove or not require specifically some disclosure requirements that are currently required today. It could, you know, add some new disclosure considerations in the standard, and indeed maybe some existing disclosure requirements could just be improved in terms of how companies would deliver them in their financial statements. So essentially we think there is a way to focus the changes we can make to the taxonomy at this time basically on those disclosures that are existing and that we don't expect the proposals that the board is working with to change. And then a significant point that we're thinking about is what I've mentioned earlier, that there might be a significant period of time before any changes that the board is thinking about in IS 19 is finalized. So that begs the need to, you know, try to see if we can make any immediate improvement to some of the very significant tagging errors that we found as it relates to how companies are tagging the disclosures of employee benefits in their financial statements today. So on that basis, so we are taking the approach of essentially proposing changes subject to your agreement in an upcoming IFRS taxonomy update so we can address some of those common reporting practices that we've addressed, that we found, rather. And as I've mentioned earlier, we think those common reporting practices that we can address at this time should only be those that relate to disclosures that won't be affected or that won't be changed, rather, by the board's proposed amendments to IAS 19. And as I've mentioned much earlier, it would mean that those remaining observed common practices will form part of the suite of feedback that the board works with when it redeliberates its proposals after the exposure draft phase. So I'd like to stop here to discuss question one, which is essentially asking if you have any questions or comments on our planned approach, which including the interaction with the disclosure project.
Sorry, so the planned taxonomy update would be towards quarter four 2020 then, that would include those?
Correct. Yes. Thank you. Everyone happy with the approach? Yes. Okay. Good to hear. So now we're going to look at the three areas that we are proposing to improve the taxonomy at this time. And this, as I mentioned earlier, relate to the defined benefit plans that an entity might have. So the first of those areas is the fair value of plan assets. So there's a requirement in IAS 19 today for an entity to disaggregate the fair value of its plan assets into different classes. And IAS 19 provides examples of classes that an entity could disaggregate into. Slide 11 shows you the line items we have in the taxonomy to support this disclosure requirement. So essentially what we have are a list of monetary line items for an entity to tag the amount of fair value of each of its different plan assets. The slide just gives you a bit more information about the tentative proposals that the board has in this area. As I've mentioned earlier, essentially the areas we're going to be looking at today are those where we're comfortable that the common practices will continue to be the case on the basis of what the board has decided. So I'm not going to go into detail on this slide for each area, but they're there for additional information if it's helpful. So in terms of what we found is that companies commonly expressed the disaggregation of the fair value in a percentage format, and they created extensions to tag them. For some of these companies, this was in addition to disclosing the monetary fair value, and again, the monetary fair values are the ones that we have line items in the taxonomy. In terms of how companies tagged this percentage, there were two equally common methods. The first is the line item modeling approach, which is essentially where companies created extensions for percent elements for each class of asset that they had. The second approach was the dimensional approach, which essentially had where companies created extension elements for a percentage allocation item, and then they use the classes of asset access to associated with that as well. So given that the practice met our common practice, our criteria to include common practice elements in the taxonomy, we then explored the best approach for us to introduce percent elements into the taxonomy. Firstly, we looked at a decimal approach. So this is an approach where the elements that we would add would require preparers to specify the type of element, so they would need to specify whether it's monetary or if it's percent. And we thought this approach would likely lead to more, tagging errors, because they would have to go through the process of actually specifying so users can understand the information that they're providing. So we did not explore this approach further on that basis. Then we looked at the pros and cons of the two equally common approach that companies use today, the first being the line item modeling approach. There are two main advantages to this approach, the first being that it would be consistent with how we've modeled the monetary value in the taxonomy, so companies won't have to change their tagging in that sense. And the second one, I mentioned earlier that the standard lists examples of classes of assets that an entity could disaggregate into, and it's on that basis that we introduced elements into the taxonomy. We did not find any other commonly created classes of assets, and that to us reduces the need of the alternative being a dimensional approach, because a benefit of the dimensional approach is if you have an extension class of asset, then you can just link that to the access, but that was not the case in this instance. And then the only disadvantage we identified with this approach is it relates to length, so it would add to the number of elements to the IFRS taxonomy relative to, for example, a dimensional modeling approach. A main disadvantage of the dimensional modeling approach in this case is it would require us to change how we've modeled the monetary value elements in the taxonomy, and this would have cost for both preparers and users. So given the different points that I outlined earlier, what we're proposing to do is to add elements in the taxonomy using the line item modeling approach. And this is because we think the benefits of a dimensional approach would not outweigh the cost, as was shown on the previous slide. So slide 15 shows the different elements that we would be including in the taxonomy as a consequence of this approach. So I'll turn it over to you to discuss question two, which asks whether you agree with this proposal.
John.
Answer a question with a question. To what extent, are there situations in which by disclosing the monetary values, you can't then derive the percentage? I mean, if people can derive the percentage, why encourage people to actually tag that percentage? Because the deriving it is a click.
So yes, when you have the monetary breakdown, you can derive by yourself the percentage. But then there were cases where all companies provided was just the percentage, so they didn't provide the monetary values, and they just had, here are my classes of assets, this is my breakdown of plan assets, you know, cash and cash equivalent is 15%, and that's it. So in a case where they also had the monetary, then it's basically just providing the same information in different formats.
Seems like it would be good to encourage people just to provide the monetary amount and forget about the percentages, but maybe that's just...
That would be prescriptive.
Yeah. That would be prescriptive, which I know is evil. Yeah.
Ashok.
I've been told.
Ashok?
If I have to cast my vote, it will be approach one. Easy. Easy to tag, easy to model, and also calculation structure, and therefore validation error. So my vote is for approach one rather than approach two.
I was just wondering whether this does capture the distinction between quoted and unquoted that from memory 19 kind of calls for, because from memory I think I've tended to see a batch of quoted instruments followed by a batch of unquoted instruments in disclosures, and is that captured by this?
It's not captured by this, and we don't actually have specific elements in the taxonomy for that. It is specified in the standard. It was actually surprising to me because as part of the sample of financial statements we looked at, not a lot of companies differentiated quoted unquoted. I mean, that's different because that's a different issue because that's part of like not fully complying with the disclosures and the standard. But to answer your question, no, this wouldn't look at quoted or unquoted, and I don't think we have specific elements in the taxonomy for that.
Is that something maybe to consider for those companies that do pull it apart and have quoted equities, for example, followed by unquoted equities?
I mean, when we did look at the sample, quoted or unquoted, given the fact that we don't have elements for in the taxonomy, it didn't come up as... It didn't meet the common practice criteria, essentially. So essentially not a lot of companies disclosed it. But I mean, it is something to think about, I mean, given that it's a disclosure requirement.
Ought to think about that, given that it is a disclosure requirement. It may be something that we need to look into. It sounds like we have some missing elements in the taxonomy in relation to that particular area, and we should perhaps have a look at it. We could perhaps combine it into any proposed taxonomy update that we do in relation to this. So, yes, yeah. I think we need to look into that further.
Suzanne?
We had actually a couple of questions. The voluntary percent that they're tagging, just to be absolutely 100% clear, it's not the target allocation, which is a U.S. GAAP.
No, it's not.
It's purely, and then are people trying to do the target allocation percent-wise as well?
Yes, we did see a few companies do the target allocation, but significant enough for companies.
And then the only other question was sort of how, double-checking how the sort of any of the other fair value things in the rest of the IFRS standards are being modeled. So other places where you need the class of assets, is it dimensional, is it line item? And we just wanted to sort of understand how consistent that is, and I think our team was a little split. Some people preferred the dimension, switching everything to dimensions. Some people could see the simplicity, but had a question about how it's done for similar types of issues elsewhere in the standards or in the GAAP taxonomy.
I think we definitely have a class of assets.
Yes.
Thing. So I think that could, in principle, lead to some confusion and people asking that question. But here we had to consider already the existing model, which were line items. So if we had to go to the dimensional model, that meant quite a lot of rate tagging for existing foreign private issues with no clear benefits. And that's why I'm very interested when you say some of your team was more in favor of the dimensional model. Besides the arguments that Ashley already has put forward, were there particular arguments or particular reasons why they would have preferred a dimensional model?
I'd have to go back to them and double check, because we just were sort of getting some reads on the group, and I'm happy to find that out and email you separately or whatever, sort of why. I think GAAP is dimensional, right? U.S. GAAP. So
we see a lot of variety in the types of investments that. It's not just that kind of set list. It's all over the place. So led to a dimensional.
But I'm not sure it was. Don't take that as I'm saying they wanted you to switch because U.S. GAAP is a bit more things. And, you know, just I'll come back to you on that.
No, and if we started completely from the beginning, then we tried to be more consistent. I mean, we had to consider here we had already existing line items in the taxonomy. And because we didn't see that variety in the different type of classes of assets, we didn't see the compelling argument to switch our existing modeling approach for this.
Yeah, so that segues into my question and kind of answers my question, is to what, from an accounting perspective, do we really see that much difference in the IFRS reporting and the GAAP reporting for pensions? Or is it just the specific disclosure requirements that there's some variability? I mean, because, again, we see a lot of variability in how these disclosures are reported, and you're not seeing the variability, right? I mean, that's why we have the dimensions in this case. We wouldn't use line items because we'd have too many extensions. That's where we would end up. But if the reporting requirements are different, that could result in a different modeling choice.
I must admit, I don't know what the U.S. reporting requirements look like in detail in relation to pensions. I suspect one of the reasons why we're seeing sort of more consistency is that we do have that sort of reasonably comprehensive list of the sorts of assets that we're looking for in the disclosure. And I wonder if that drives the greater sort of consistency or the consistency that we're seeing in the reporting under IFRS, and whether, and as I said, I don't know, do you have anything comparable?
Narrative description of
I was going to say, I think we have a similar list, and we actually might have more on the list, but it's kind of in a paragraph, so it almost looks like, here's examples, where yours is very, structured.
Yeah.
So it almost
I wonder if just the format has lent itself to, oh, this is what they're looking for, where ours is just kind of, it's part of narrative, so whatever you want to do.
It's kind of principles.
So it's kind of funny when I looked at it, I'm like, I wonder if that's driving people are reporting the format.
It's interesting how we come to such different conclusions.
Yes.
Although I guess the question is, if you were starting from scratch.
I think we probably have been more inclined than, I think, to go.
It would be interesting to see how it moves forward, because tentatively what the board has essentially decided with the fair value, so it's retaining, suggesting that the fair value of plan assets is a way to kind of provide useful information. But what we're currently working with is not to have a defined list of examples of or to propose not having, associating that with a examples of classes of assets. So I wonder how much that's going to shift to what we're currently seeing, just to whatever extent.
We also have a statement, these examples are not meant to be all-inclusive.
I think the intention in our standard is exactly the same, but it's maybe read in a somewhat different way.
So, provided in a slightly different way.
Yeah, and just having that additional language may have lent itself to more, they don't mean to just have that list.
As someone of note recently said, convergence is complicated.
I think so. I just wanted to confirm, because we did some studies on the main contributors of extensions, so like an attribution report, so which of the nodes are the most significant, and not just for us, but also for our peers. And pension and employee benefits is top 3 of out of 10, so it's 15%. So I think it must be something principle based from this, because it's very, very specific IFRS. You may conclude, as a lot of IFRS filers have in the same area a lot of high extension rates, then it seems to be some principle based there. But that's just like an first finding which we have. I think it's a good area where we can have more common practice to improve that.
So I take it we agree with the proposal to...
You're not hearing voices of dissent, I think you can take that as agreement.
Thank you. So moving on to the second area of common practice findings, which is on the reconciliation of the net defined benefit liability or asset. So for an entity that has a defined benefit plan, IAS 19 requires it to essentially recognize an amount that's equal to the net defined benefit liability in its balance sheet. And there is a disclosure requirement for that entity to reconcile the opening to closing balance of that net defined benefit liability amount. And the requirement is a bit more detailed in the sense that it requires that reconciliation to show essentially separate columns for the plan assets, the present value of defined benefit obligation, and the effect of the asset ceiling, so the three components that amount to determining that net amount. In terms of how we've modeled this disclosure requirement in the standard, we've done essentially a dimensional modeling approach. So we have a disclosure of net defined benefit liability table. Slide 17 shows you the axis, the members of this axis. And slide 18 shows the existing line items that we have associated with this table. So a bit more in terms of essentially how we've modeled it and what that means for reporting. So the line items in this table have balance attributes that essentially indicate whether the value to report should be indicated with a positive sign or with a negative sign in the XBRL filing. So for a line item that has a credit balance attribute, we're essentially representing essentially means that the reconciling change is an increase in the net defined benefit liability and would have a positive, we expect a positive sign. When a line item that has a debit balance attribute, it is relating to a reconciling change that decreases the net defined benefit liability, and we're expecting similarly a positive sign when that line item is used. So there's an example here to show what this means for how companies should tag their reconciliation. So looking at the interest on pensions role, we have an element, one of the line items in this table is the interest expense element, and that element has a credit balance attribute because the interest expense increases the net defined benefit liability. So when a company is expecting to tag the value of 568, which in this case is the interest income, we expect the company to use the interest expense element, but to change the sign to a negative sign because interest income decreases the net defined benefit liability. And this we expect regardless of whether of how the company chooses to present the values in this table. So in this case, the company has presented that with a negative 568 in brackets, but they would also, our expectations for tagging is also the same if this value was simply 568 or however else they decide to design around the number. There's another standard slide that gives you a bit more information of how we've arrived that some companies would, we expect them to continue to disclose information similar to the reconciliation that's required today. In terms of what we found, so there are two sets of common reporting practice that we found. The first relates to incorrect tagging. So I've talked about what our expectations for tagging meant with how we've modeled the requirement. So the first area is in regards to some incorrect tagging in that space. And then secondly, the presentation of additional line items above and beyond what the standard specifically identifies in this reconciliation. So looking first at incorrect tagging. So what we found is that companies commonly presented positive values, in particular under the fair value of plan assets separate reconciliation. In addition, companies used our dimensional approach in the taxonomy, so they used the net defined benefit axis to tag their whole reconciliation. However, some companies used the elements we have in the reconciliation table but did not change the sign in the way that we expect signs to be changed. So I talked earlier that the value of 568 for interest income we expect to be associated with a negative sign, but in this case what we found a lot of companies doing was to essentially report a positive sign, which, you know, doesn't exactly convey the correct accounting meaning of this value, because by associating the 568 with a positive sign, a user could interpret that value to be interest expense instead of interest income, whereas interest expense is actually the 1,890 value. So some of these companies use what we have in the taxonomy but didn't change the sign. Other companies instead just created extensions to tag this value. So we found lots of extensions for interest income on plan assets instead of using our taxonomy element. So our view is that both of these common practices, so using the line items without changing the sign, as well as creating extensions, we see them as incorrect practices. In particular, the risk that the sign errors, the risk of sign errors is particular for certain line item, reconciling line items, and these are those line items that affect the separate reconciliation. So in the case of interest expense or income that I mentioned earlier, interest expense only affects the defined benefit obligation and interest income affects the fair value of plan asset, but they have opposite effects towards the net defined benefit liability. So what it means is that companies need to use opposite signs so they're conveying the right accounting meaning of these different values. And same for the other reconciling line items that are mentioned on this slide. So as I've mentioned earlier, we think this tagging practices are incorrect, and there were actually quite a significant number of companies in the sample that were doing this, so we think there's that warrants it to be addressed. We considered two options as a result. the first option is to essentially retain the dimensional modeling approach that we have today, but to provide some additional guidance to clarify that the sign that we expect companies to report with these values. The sort of clarification we are looking at are essentially to amend the element labels of these line items, and then to add guidance labels or implementation notes to those line items in particular that affect the different the two main separate reconciliation columns. There are a number of advantages for this approach, the first being that we think it would resolve the sign errors that we've identified if preparers do pay attention to the guidance that's provided. We also think it would reduce the number of companies that are creating extensions because we think the efforts under this approach would make the meaning of the elements clearer. Thirdly, preparers would not have to retag the reconciliation they provided in previous years because we are retaining the model that we currently have. And then relative to, you know, the alternative, it would result in fewer elements in the taxonomy in total. A main disadvantage, and the only disadvantage we could identify for this approach, is that some preparers may not pay attention to the guidance label in the implementation notes. So it still retains some risk that the sign errors that we've identified would remain. The other option that we considered is to switch to a line item modeling approach. So in this case, what we would do is to remove the net defined benefit liability axis, and then we would create separate line items for each of the separate reconciliation columns that companies are required to do. The advantages of this are that it would be more intuitive to use because the tagging would match how companies present values in the paper-based financial statement. And similar to the first option, it would reduce the number of extensions that companies are creating today. There are quite a number of disadvantages for this approach, however. The first being that there would be a cost to the market, in particular for preparers and users, because they're going to have to essentially retag or remap the reconciliation in previous years. Under this approach, there's still the risk of sign errors, because some companies could still present either the column for the plan assets or the column for the defined benefit obligation in negative values, so in the way of this slide, for example, and in that case, there's still the risk that they might get the signs wrong in that sense. And then in this case, there would be more elements added to the taxonomy relative to the first option. So in light of those considerations, what we are proposing is the first option, which is to retain our dimensional model approach, but to provide additional guidance, as I've mentioned earlier, to clarify the signs that we expect companies to report. And this is because, as I've mentioned earlier, we think there would be quite a significant burden to preparers and users of changing the approach to a line item, in particular because this still we think it's unlikely to actually fully address the risk of sign errors. So slide 26 gives a visual representation of what the consequence of our proposed approach would mean for the taxonomy. So looking at the interest expense line item, our proposed element label would essentially be changed so that it directly clarifies the direction of the relationship between, in this case, interest expense and the net defined benefit liability. And then, as you can see, the proposed guidance label specifies that in the case of an interest expense, we want a positive value with that element. And in the case of an interest income, it should be tagged with a negative value. So that brings me to question three for you, which asks whether you agree with our proposals to clarify the sign to report for the line items in the disclosure of net defined benefit liability table by firstly amending the element labels of all the line items to clarify the direction of relationship, and secondly to add guidance labels or implementation notes so that it specifically identifies the sign that we expect in each situation. So I'll turn it over to you for discussion, questions or comments.
Just one question, as you very often use the term incorrect tagging. So does it mean for you that paper-based there was a different sign as in the electronic, Or does it mean for you that you would expect in the electronic a different sign convention? Because the question is, if the paper-based says positive or negative, and the tagging is then also corresponds with that, it's not a tagging issue, but then it's an issue of the paper-based. So that's the paper-based needs to change.
I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that when you look at it in the context of the paper-based reporting, it's actually relatively easy to see what's going on. So, you know, it might have been better if they put brackets around it to make it clear, but because it's headed up with the asset, it's pretty clear what's going on. But when you translate that out of context into the electronic reporting, it becomes a problem. So, again, it's just down to the difference between the paper-based, where you have everything in context, and so it's less easy to be misled, versus the electronic reporting, where actually it becomes much more of an issue.
Because usually you use signing conventions within the 20F or within the report, and some simply say a positive is an expense figure, so it's for the whole report. I mean, such signing convention exists, and if you then tag this, you cannot. You would make a mistake if you change it in your electronic, because then the electronic would not fit to your paper based, which is even I think worse, because then so that's my only concern for this one. If you're talking about signing convention, because I think it's really a convention question. It's not an accounting question, because from accounting perspective you can define an expense in a different way, like what you do very often now.
I mean, you can have a convention there, but you can end up in a situation where you have, for example, a liability note. Obviously, your liability note, you're not going to be using brackets around every single figure. And the problem that you've got when you look at the pensions note is that you're combining both assets and liabilities. And so you can, and often you've got a deficit there. And so what you do is, in the paper-based report, you switch the normal convention. Your liabilities will be there without the brackets, and your assets will be there with the brackets. As I said, in the paper-based, it doesn't cause confusion, but I can see how it can, in the electronic world, cause confusion.
Okay.
I think in an electronic world, we have this tagging convention. So in an electronic world, it's defined. There's only one convention, irrespective of how you have presented in your paper report. The problem is because preparers who tag this information are familiar with how they present it in their paper reports, and they're less familiar with how you have to do that using that convention in XBRL, and that's where the confusion comes in, because they say, okay, I've tagged it as a negative here, I'm going to tag it now as a negative in my electronic report as well. Whereas, in fact, there is a strict convention in the electronic report, whereas there is not a convention in the paper report.
I was struggling with this one. So let me just take you through. So if you refer to slide 19 and the table.
Yes.
So 568 is interest on pension, meaning is income.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
So we know income is credit type. And we also know that in XBRL, value should be more like a more positive side. Okay? So instead of, you know, the putting the bracket, we'll leave aside about the bracket in a minute, but it should be a positive number.
But I think the context here changes it a bit, because this is a reconciliation context, and we've done it from the perspective of the liability, not the answer, which is, I think, changes that a little bit.
Yeah. Now, let me just refer you back again to slide, and that's where the confusion starts. Slide 23. Majority, you know, the concept you now introducing here, if you really look at interest expense and income, two separate treatment, one credit, one debit, and now two-way tag into one particular type of balance. And then, you know, the whole issue of the signers. So that's where, you know, that particular table is one way, interest on, you know, the pension. It's only one way, you know, the transactions. Now here in this particular slide, interest, expense, and income. It's a two different, you know, the accounting treatment. And so the signer is going to get so confused. So I'm really struggling with this one. So which approach to go for it?
we have here an interesting thing that we're mixing. We're describing things as interest expense and income, but we're actually talking about the change in the value of a liability, but effectively the change in the balance of an asset rather than the income side. So we're looking at sort of the other end of a transaction anyway. The thing we're describing is actually the change in the liability because of the interest expense.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with this sort of multiple flipping of balance that you're talking about. So the point is that the thing that we're describing, the expense, is, as the tag, as the element is given, I can never remember which is which, it's a credit. But your immediate assumption was that an interest expense is a debit. Yeah, and that's where we go wrong to start with.
No, and that's
so that sign of this element is the wrong is the opposite to what sometimes you might think it is, but is right for the change in the total of the liability.
And that's why we changed the standard label as well. If you look now at the standard label, we said increase, decrease in this, through this, rather than starting off interest, income, expenses, on whatever it was before. So now you're really saying, okay, what we're really looking for is the increase, decrease through change X. That's what we are saying. It still takes your head getting round to, but I think that's why we still say, okay, even if we change the label, it's still difficult. And that's why in the guidance label, we're really telling you, look, if it's an interest expense, you do this. Mm-hmm. If it's an interest income, is a change through an interest income, you do that, really.
Intuitively, I think is what you just said is makes perfect sense. But the other part is also getting the whole calculation, the structure right, both horizontally and vertically. And where this sign is business and forcing, the positive value into negated thing may cause, depends on the circumstances, and the whole issue of calculation inconsistency and errors.
Later on, in the slides later on, we're starting to look at the other end of these transactions, and then you'll start to see the signs the way around you're expecting them. So which is why we need to change this label to really distinguish what we're talking about precisely.
DQC rules will help us in due course.
Donna?
Yeah, I mean, kind of getting to where that was my point is, I think the way it was labeled before was a little confusing because it really wasn't interest expense. It is really an increase to the liability. And you really have to separate the presentation from what the data is. You have to say, what is that value, that 568, what does that represent, a debit? That element is a credit, so the sign has to be reversed. It's just separate from what's on the paper to what's actually reported, because it does get confusing. And you really have to align the label with the balance attribute. In that case, it almost seemed opposite, because you had a credit, but you're saying its interest expense was positive. So that, I think, was confusing, and I think this should help. The other will Calc 2.0 help with that as well, because you'll be able to add across dimensions?
Mm-hmm.
I look at it all in, right?
with the definition of the elements as they are now, if we see the table, then what you now have is a clear, at the moment the calcs work fine in terms of a clear opening about, well, they don't, because they don't work across time. So the calc will deal with this in two ways. You can see the logic of the table is an opening balance, the changes to that, and the closing balance. And Calc 2 will allow us to actually describe
to that
calculation properly, and it will be obvious then that the things should have the
doesn't
same
work.
Balance attributes as the things they're changing. And also will be allow you to say that to do the across-dimension chain calculation to show that the total is this plus that.
That should
again,
help.
The fact that should be negative, so it ends up reducing the total becomes more obvious.
Peter?
Only a small suggestion. Given the confusion over the sign convention, for completeness, I wondered if perhaps the guidance label could also mention that interest on the asset ceiling should be expressed as a positive value as well, which doesn't come up as often, but maybe that makes it even more helpful given that it's not something people would typically see.
Thank you.
Okay. So, we've got an answer for that.
Yes. Thank you.
The second area of findings as it relates to the reconciliation is on new line items. So what we found is companies commonly disclose additional line items above that which is specifically identified in IAS 19. The first is that companies commonly disclose the administrative cost of the defined benefit plans in their reconciliation, and this would typically be included under the section on profit or loss changes. And then secondly, companies commonly grouped their reconciling items into three buckets, so those buckets being profit and loss changes, other comprehensive income changes, and then other changes like, you know, contributions and the likes. And so our proposals as it relates to this are to add elements into the taxonomy that would accommodate tagging of this new line items. And as you can see from slide 29, the element labels for this line items are taking the form of the clarification that we propose for the existing line items, so we don't run into the same sign issues that we've seen today. As it relates in particular to the third element on this slide, which is accommodating the disclosure of the total amount in other comprehensive income, we actually already have a line item in the reconciliation table for this today. So our proposal in this case is to make some amendments to the element label just so it's clearly distinguished from the second line item, which is the one on profit or loss. So I'll pause there to see if you agree to discuss question four, which asks whether you agree with these proposals.
Just maybe to check I've understood correctly. So are we talking about admin costs that have been incurred in connection with the pension scheme, or are we talking about expenses in P&L, such as service cost and interest and so on, that have been presented within a caption called admin expenses?
It's the former. Okay. So it's that related to that, yeah.
So would those expenses apply only against the liability?
So it was in the same way that, I guess, interest expense income works. So some companies had administrative expenses for the defined benefit obligation and then administrative expenses for the plan asset. So it would work with the separate reconciliations as well. And the same clarification in the guidance label would
work. Right, increase, decrease.
Maybe just on the language that's proposed for that line item, I wonder whether others might fall into the dilemma I had a second ago of when we talk about the movement in the pension scheme through admin expenses. I think, at least in my jurisdiction, people would often think of admin expenses as a line item similar to cost of sales. And so if the idea is that, no, this is administrative costs recognised in profit or loss, that might be a more intuitive title.
We can definitely explore that, but it might be worth mentioning that in terms of an Appendix A shows how they fit into the structure. So the element that we're proposing to add here would be listed under the suite of line items that's reported under the profit or loss. I don't know if to what extent that helps with what you've rephrased. So it doesn't show the full set of line items, but the second reddened line item, which is the one on administrative expenses, it's shown under the header of profit or loss.
Yeah, I think maybe it's just language through, and that we could look at changing it. It might be something as simple as replacing that with because of, rather than through.
Or replacing expenses with costs, maybe.
Okay, so that's all we had on the second area of changes, which is relating to reconciliation. So moving on to the final area that we're proposing changes to at this time on defined benefit plans, and this is the topic on disaggregating the amounts that's presented in the primary financial statement within the notes. So the IS-19 currently has a disclosure objective that essentially requires an entity to explain the amount that it has in its financial statement that came about from its defined benefit plans. The reconciliation requirement that we just looked at in the standard is specifically attached to this objective. However, other than that requirement, there isn't anything else the standard requires an entity to disaggregate into. The slide shows the few common practice elements that we have in the taxonomy to allow companies to tag any separate disaggregation that they might provide, other than what we currently have for the reconciliation as well. So in terms of what we found in this area, what we found is that a lot of companies commonly provided a detailed disaggregation of the amounts that they had in the primary financial statements, specifically on statements of comprehensive income and statement of financial position. So they would provide a separate disaggregation separately from what they might provide in the reconciliation format. So they're, in a sense, providing the same information in different contexts. So it's what we were talking about from the liability context and then just from the straight-up expenses and position context, and the slide 33 provides an example from an financial statement extract. So in terms of how companies tagged this disclosure, as it relates to the separate disaggregation of the amount in the statement of financial position, what we found is that most companies used the common practice elements that we already have. So these are the elements on the left-hand side of this slide, which are separate from the reconciliation. What we found is that most companies use those line items to tag that disaggregation. However, as it relates to tagging the detailed disaggregation of the amounts in the statement of comprehensive income, there were diverse approaches. Some created extensions. However, other companies use the elements that we currently have in the reconciliation table, and you can imagine for some of the reasons we've already talked about it, just stated as like in case of current service costs, so they probably thought that would work as well. But what they didn't do was to change the sign to reflect the context that this value was now being reported. And as we'll look at in subsequent slides, so there were a few issues associated with that approach. Similar to the reconciliation context, when companies provided a separate disaggregation, they provided some additional line items that we don't have elements for in the taxonomy. So again, here, the administrative cost, disaggregating interest into interest expense and interest income, and then also grouping and providing the total of amount in profit or loss separately from other comprehensive income. As it relates to other comprehensive income, based on the requirement in IFRS standards, this could either be done before tax or after tax, and we currently have elements elsewhere in the taxonomy to tag the total whenever it's presented within the statement itself. So as it relates to what we found and what companies were disaggregating in the notes, they were also doing either before tax or after tax for the individual line items in other comprehensive income as well. So I mentioned earlier the tagging approach that companies used for the statement of comprehensive income and the issues that we've identified with that. The first being that the value is in effect incorrectly conveyed when the line items in the reconciliation table is used without changing the sign. And this slide illustrates that with the example of current service cost. So the current service cost that we have in the reconciliation table is associated with a credit balance attribute because current service cost in that context increases the net defined benefit liability. So if that element is used in this case to tag the pure, expense for current service cost, then it would be identified in effect as a positive value with a credit balance attribute. However, as Ashok rightly pointed earlier on, when you have expenses, it is a debit balance attribute. So the fact of not changing the sign to indicate that it's a debit is something that's essentially giving incorrect information in a sense. The second issue we identified is relating to XBRL calculation. So the modeling approach we have for the reconciliation table is a dimensional modeling approach. So if companies are using that to tag the separate disaggregation, as you can see on the slide, it would in effect be combining different access members, and the current XBRL calculations would not support that in effect. So the practice of disclosing separate disaggregation of amounts outside of the reconciliation was something we found to be common, so it met our criteria to introduce common practice elements in the taxonomy. So then we considered the best way in which we could try to bring in those elements, and we considered two main approaches. The first one is for us to maintain the line items that we have in the reconciliation table, but to remove their balance attributes. And the process of removing the balance attributes would essentially allow a company to use the elements to tag both the reconciliation context as well as the separate disaggregation context. The main advantage of this approach is that we would only have one element in the taxonomy for each of those economic concepts, so we would only have one element for current service cost, and that would apply irrespective of whether it's in the reconciliation or in a different presentation format. There are, however, a number of disadvantages with this approach, the first being that preparers would have to determine the signs that they report themselves in both the reconciliation context, and then they would have to adjust it to do the opposite sign for the separate disaggregation context. And our view is that that is likely to lead to more tagging errors than we've actually identified today already. The second is that we don't think this approach would reduce those companies that are creating extensions today. In effect, it might increase the number of extensions because this approach could be seen as more confusing because it would remove the balance attributes. And then, as we've mentioned before, the calculation relationships would not work still because we would still be having the dimensional modeling and the mixing of different access members in that sense. The second approach we explored was to retain the line items we have in the reconciliation table as is, but then to provide separate line items for companies to tag the separate disaggregation context. There are a number of advantages to this approach, first being that the labels and the balance attributes of the two sets of elements, line items we would have, would indicate the correct sign to report for their respective context. It would be more intuitive to use, and as a result, we think it would reduce the sign errors that we see today. And thirdly, it would reduce the need for those companies that create extensions today. And then finally, a big advantage of this is that the calculation relationships would work because the line items we would introduce for the separate disaggregation context would essentially be a line item modeling, if you will. The disadvantage of this approach is the one where, you know, in a case of current service costs, we have two different elements in the taxonomy that represent current service costs, and that's the disadvantage. So having analyzed the two, what we're proposing is option B, which is to provide separate line items for the different contexts that we've seen companies disaggregate the amounts in their financial statements into. What this approach would mean is that we would introduce both new line items into the table that we currently have in the taxonomy, and would also bring in some of the existing common practice elements that we have about disaggregation so that companies can tag the separate disaggregation context. So this relates to the one for comprehensive income. As I mentioned earlier, as it relates to the disaggregation for the statement of financial position, we already have common practice elements for those, and companies are using them. So that brings us to our last question for you on this topic, which is asking whether you agree with our proposal to add line items so companies can tag the separate disaggregation of amounts relating to defined benefit plans.
Option B wins.
I was just going to add that on the nature of the sort of the guidance elements that we're adding today, it would be useful if you do create multiple line items, that there is something that kind of refers to the other one, given the change in the taxonomy that we're putting through.
Or like a cross-reference, yes, between the two.
That cross-reference is exactly what I'm thinking of.
Just going to say, would there be guidance on, you know, this is used for this purpose and the other is used? I mean, there may be a cross-reference, but is there a risk that they would be kind of interchanged, given that there's already some signage errors? I don't know.
I guess there would be, they would sit in different parts of the presentation link base, so
yeah, mean, is that enough, given some of the tools just kind of give you a list of elements and people may not be looking at the presentation link base so specifically? It's just a question.
Well, it because based on what I've heard is that, look, okay, we were thinking, okay, by putting in the presentation context, by rolling it up to these existing elements that already exist in the IFRS taxonomy, the presentation context of taxonomy should provide enough information to do it. But then if you have a tool with just search on a label, you can imagine that they say, okay, they found the first one, they say, okay, I'm going to use this one. So I think we probably need to think about it a little bit, either by changing the label or maybe by giving additional guidance. But then again, it's never going to be 100% foolproof, because if they don't look at the guidance, then we're still in problems. But there's only that much that you can do as well. I think, again, also, I think calculations may walk a little bit, because if calculations are required for the notes and these items roll up to these items that we have already in our taxonomy, again, there is some benefit. But let's explore and see if through the use of labels or through the use of guidance labels, we can even more clarify how we intend these elements to be used. Yeah. But this was one a confusing topic for ourselves, for us as well. And it's definitely where we had received feedback from stakeholders as well, that they were quite confused with how to model it.
Mm-hmm. That's all the questions I had for you on employee benefits, and thank you.
Just check if you are still on the line. You might have fallen asleep, being 2 a.m. Are you there on the line?
Yes, I'm still awake.
Well done. Impressive. Do you have any things you'd like to add for this section? Questions, we've been doing the questions 1 through 5. Did you have any things to add?
No, I do not. Probably when we think more about some of the proposal, we will email the team.
That would be great. Thank you very much, and well done staying awake. We've got more for you if you can keep staying awake. We have more. Okay, you all right?
Yes.
Well done.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right.